طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. That is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. The Amnesty International report that established evidence that Israel is committing the international crime of apartheid has been harshly attacked by the Biden administration and the U.S. Congress, and, of course, the Jewish establishment. Here is Mehdi Hassan of NBC News reporting on the Amnesty International report and the reaction to it on his news program on Peacock.
In a scathing new report, Amnesty International accuses Israel of committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians in the occupied territories and Israel, and against Palestinian refugees. The 274-page report, a product of 4 years of work, research, and on-the-ground reporting, says that Israel has imposed a system of oppression and domination over Palestinians wherever it exercises control over the enjoyment of their rights across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory and with regard to Palestinian refugees. The segregation is conducted in a systematic and highly institutionalized manner through laws, policies, and practices, all intended to prevent Palestinians from claiming and enjoying equal rights to Jewish Israelis within Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, and thus intended to oppress and dominate the Palestinian people. Strong words. But multiple Israeli leaders, in fact, including former prime ministers Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, have warned in the past that Israel was on a path towards apartheid. John Kerry once did as well. But any time the A word is mentioned, people lose their minds. South Africa is immediately invoked. Defenders of Israel say it's ludicrous to compare Israel to South Africa. Israel is nothing like apartheid-era South Africa, they say. There are two problems with that argument. First, as Amnesty International itself preemptively points out, this report does not seek to argue that or assess whether any system of oppression and domination as perpetrated in Israel and the occupied territories is, for instance, the same or analogous to the system of segregation, oppression, and domination as perpetrated in South Africa between 1948 and 1994. Instead, this report analyzes the systematic discrimination currently perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians and determines whether it meets the international definition of apartheid. See, what people don't seem to get is that Israel doesn't have to be a replica of South Africa. Apartheid isn't defined by what happened in South Africa. It's defined by international law. For example, in the 1973 International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, quote, apartheid is defined as, quote, inhuman acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them. That's what the world's leading human rights groups are now saying is happening on the ground in Israel and the occupied territories. And they say it meets the definition of the crime of apartheid under international law. The second point about South Africa is that, I'm sorry to say, a lot of leading South African anti-apartheid activists, like the late Desmond Tutu, who recently passed away, thought there were similarities between apartheid in South Africa and apartheid in Israel. Have a listen.
You said that what you saw in Israel, something that was quite akin to the situation in South Africa before freedom came to the black people of South Africa.
Well, in many instances, worse. It's actually quite distressing. For one thing, there were... we didn't have a war.
And he's not the only South African to say that. Sadly, the reaction from the Israeli government and its defenders abroad to this new Amnesty report has been as predictable as it has been disingenuous. An Israeli foreign ministry spokesperson accused Amnesty of recycling lies, inconsistencies, and unfounded assertions that originate from well-known anti-Israel hate organizations. Pro-Israel groups here in the US, like the ADL, AIPAC, the Democratic Majority for Israel. They all put out ridiculous statements accusing Amnesty International, Amnesty, of inciting anti-Semitism, demonizing Israel, and allying with terrorist groups. They even accuse Amnesty of trying to delegitimize Israel's creation, because the report dares to point out that since its establishment in 1948, Israel has pursued an explicit policy of establishing and maintaining a Jewish demographic hegemony and maximizing its control over land to benefit Jewish Israelis while minimizing the number of Palestinians and restricting their rights and obstructing their ability to challenge this dispossession. What's weird is that nowadays, here in America, we don't like it when the far right tries to deny or rewrite our history, to whitewash what happened to black people when America was founded, when they try and gloss over the original sin of slavery. So why are we okay with an argument that says we shouldn't look at what happened when Israel was founded in 1948? We shouldn't cast a light on the anti-Palestinian atrocities and expulsions that occurred and that have since been documented by historians, Arab and Israeli, for decades? And are we expected to believe that Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, which last year also accused Israel of apartheid in a detailed report, that they are filled with raging anti-Semites? How about Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem and Yesh Din that have also said Israel is committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians in the occupied territories? Are they anti-Semitic too? How about a quarter of American Jews who say they think Israel is an apartheid state? Are they putting themselves in danger by saying that? Come on. Look, you don't have to believe Israel is committing apartheid against the Palestinians. You don't. You can disagree with that claim in good faith. It's a free country. And I admit it's a contentious and sensitive issue. What you cannot do is simply shout down all references to apartheid as anti-Semitic or anti-Israeli or biased or dangerous. You have to engage with the argument and with the evidence presented by multiple human rights groups. You have to read their damn reports. And you have to speak to Palestinians.
The knee-jerk attack on the report by the Jewish establishment uses language right out of the Israeli Hasbara Talking Points catalog. They parrot words like, the report is anti-Semitic, fraudulent, biased. But I have yet to see one critic make a statement that indicates they have even read the report, because they do not document their criticisms by citing what they find to be inaccurate, untrue, fraudulent, or biased. They generically criticize the report without citing directly from the report the specific problems they have with the report. And Amnesty International is not alone in its critique of the report. Human Rights Watch and the Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem also have issued lengthy reports documenting and concluding that Israel is a segregated, discriminatory, apartheid state. What is shocking is not that Washington is critical of the reports, but that they chose to trash the credibility of some of the world's most respected human rights organizations to appease Israel without offering valid criticism of the contents of the reports. The bottom line? Your president and your Congress are choosing to believe Israel over Amnesty International on the issue of human rights. And now on to our feature presentation, which is delivered by Hanan Eshwari, the first woman elected to the PLO Governing Council, who also served as its spokesperson for several years. She has also served in the Palestinian Parliament. Here she is delivering the keynote address to the annual conference of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Of course, when we discuss anything these days, we are in the context of what's been happening the last week, 7-8 days, and the eruption of violence between Russia and Ukraine. And we are seeing certain shifts and changes that have exposed the fault lines in the global system, in the international system. And of course, expose the underlying attitudes and the hypocrisy of the West with the racism and not just double standards, but multiple standards. And these global shifts, I'm sure, will be felt everywhere, particularly in our part of the world. But that is not our topic, even though we should be discussing this. Our topic, as you said, is has anything changed between the Trump legacy and the Biden assumption of power? What has changed in U.S. policy? Now, as you all know, American policy is a continuum. It has several features that form a continuity of American positions. And among them is the standard approach of a strategic alliance. Israel is our special ally. We have shared values, the Judeo-Christian traditions, as you know, and of course, unlimited economic and military support, some very visible, some hidden. And Israel's security as being paramount, or as they keep repeating, sacrosanct. The qualitative military edge, the QME, that has become a very standard expression that Israel in the region and even beyond must maintain its qualitative military edge, and therefore the U.S. foots the bill and shares the know-how with Israel. Again, the U.S. gives Israel cover for its impunity, protects it from accountability, and any approach to the region is always based on what Israeli priorities are and what Israeli interests are. And of course, traditionally, in the last at least two, three presidencies, we have had, before Trump, we have had a discussion of the two-state solution, no matter how flawed, but at least they discussed the two-state solution in the sense that the Palestinians would have the right to sovereignty, but generally all American positions were based on the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt, in which the Palestinians were granted autonomy or self-government, limited self-government or self-rule. So there was no agreement in which there was a recognition of a Palestinian right to self-determination or to sovereignty. Now, Trump based many of his positions and policies on the same, on these principles, but he accelerated and intensified the worst of them while creating certain disruptions and diversions in other areas and some things that are not as harmful. For example, he exhibited total disdain for international law and international humanitarian law and pursued systemic violations of the law with, again, an assault on multilateralism and the global rule of law, which cemented, of course, Israeli impunity and aggression. And as you know, they left the U.S. left UNESCO and left the Human Rights Council because the Palestinians were admitted to the membership there. They dismissed occupation or rendered it invisible and not illegal, since the ideological component said that this is Jewish territory. The settlements are not illegal. Now you'll be drinking Pompeii wine from a settlement right next to Ramallah, near my house, actually. They recognized and reinforced annexation, primarily the annexation of Jerusalem, and this is the most egregious step. Not just did they recognize annexation, they moved the embassy there, and we call it a settlement now. We have an American settlement in Jerusalem. They closed the consulate in Jerusalem, which was opened in 1844 as the diplomatic mission to Palestine. So Israel, way before Israel was created, this consulate existed, and it was a diplomatic mission to Palestine. They closed it down in order to make any representation of the U.S. purely Israeli and within Jerusalem. And they recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights. Of course, I don't think that the Trump settlement will materialize, but I think you still have the sign of Trump Heights or Trump settlement in the Golan Heights. And of course, they closed the Palestinian office in Washington, D.C. The second main feature is that they totally abandoned the pretense at the two-state solution or traditional U.S. policy to accommodate Netanyahu. It was a great alliance with Netanyahu, and they said openly there's no Palestinian sovereignty or recognition, and they recognized the Jewish state in the sense that the nation state law says there is no self-determination for anybody in historical Palestine, which we call Eretz Israel, except for the Jews. So they, again, were party to quite a racist, exclusive ideology. And third, they introduced, again, a glaring and blatant ideological identification and components, plus fundamentalism, extreme Christian evangelical fundamentalism, as represented by Pompeo and Pence, extreme Jewish fundamentalism, Zionism, as expressed by David Friedman and, to a certain extent, Jason Greenblatt when he was in office, and, of course, extreme Zionism with Jared Kushner and Ivanka. In this mix, you add racism and white supremacy, populism, and all sorts of racist positions like Islamophobia, as well as anti-Semitism. The U.S., therefore, moved from being an ally of Israel to a partner in crime, in the war crimes and crimes against humanity that Israel was committing constantly. It is no longer a question of the influence of the Israel lobby or lobbies of many different pro-Israeli groups and the congressional negative intervention. Now we see Israelis and pro-Israelis in the White House and in the State Department as decision makers. This is quite a difference. Five, they embraced the partnership with Netanyahu and turned it into Israel into a Republican issue. Of course, it started before with Obama and the intervention of Netanyahu in American politics. We'll discuss this when we look at the JCPOA. But also, we see the emergence of a very bizarre phenomenon of the anti-Semitic Zionists, in the sense that I can be as anti-Semitic and racist as I want, provided I support Israel. I'm a loyal Zionist. Along with that, there is the dehumanization of the Palestinians. The terrorism charge or the terrorism label re-emerged. And it was Tillerson, I think, who refused to give us a waiver. As you know, Palestinians are always under probation. They are on good behavior. They have to prove that they deserve their rights. And so the only way that we can have some sort of dialogue or relationship with the U.S. is if we are engaged with Israel in serious, meaningful negotiations. And therefore, the State Department gives a recommendation to the president to waive the terrorism charge and therefore to continue the dialogue. And of course, Tillerson did not ask for a waiver, and immediately we were not just on probation or good behavior, but we failed the test according to them. And therefore, we don't deserve our rights. Along with that, of course, you have the legislation of the Taylor Force Act and APCA and the legal liability and so on. So it was compiling all sorts of obstacles in order to exclude the Palestinians and to continue a process of defunding. When they defunded the Palestine, they, of course, increased Israeli support. It's not just the $38 billion that the Obama administration promised. The support was some of it visible and some not. But they defunded Palestine on infrastructure, even hospitals in Jerusalem, even scholarships to people, and so on. But they tried to maintain some sort of security support. They defunded UNRWA, which is very serious, because they were redefining UNRWA by redefining the Palestinian refugee status. They adopted the extreme right Israeli definition of Palestinian refugee by saying these refugees are only those who left in 1948. Which means that there are only 20 or 40,000 Palestinian refugees and not the 5.5 million that UNRWA defines as registered refugees, let alone those who are not registered. So they are also trying to dissolve the refugee issue. And they put pressure on the Arabs and other countries to defund Palestine and not to give the Palestinians any assistance. And it worked because the Arabs have stopped. Until now, I think only one country gave some assistance, Algiers. But the underlying principles of the Obama policy were bashing the Palestinians into submission. And as part of that, we must accept or internalize the fact, as he said, or the mentality of defeat. And this was something that I think Daniel Pipes invented at one point. It was picked up by Jared Kushner, and they said everything would be fine if only the Palestinians would accept the fact that they are defeated. And they don't know and or understand the Palestinians or who we are. I mean, we may be under occupation, we may be punished daily, we may be under the most oppressive criminal regime, but we are not defeated, we have not been defeated, and we are a people who are resilient and who will persist. We will discuss this later. But Kushner's economic peace, or the prosperity to peace, and the Manama Bahrain conference was precisely set up in order to force the Palestinians to exchange their rights or abandon our rights in exchange for a few handouts and imaginative handouts. And Trump's notorious ultimate deal, or as is known, the deal of the century, was based on that, that we don't have to have our rights, that annexation can be legalized, that Israel's control can be maintained, and you can bribe the Palestinians with some minuscule support and we will behave. It seems obviously, of course, they don't understand history, they don't understand the region, they don't understand Palestinian culture or identity or spirit. And the final most important thing they did was the regional realignment and polarization through normalization. They attempted to redefine and reorganize the region on the basis of a major rift or polarization, the Sunni-Shiite divide. And of course, it started by nullifying the JCPOA because they had to create Iran as the major enemy in their attempts at redefining who's a friend and who's a foe, who's an enemy and who's an ally. They tried to turn Iran into a major regional enemy, representing the extreme Shiites in their parlance, and that Israel is an ally of the moderate Sunnis. And therefore, this polarization is what has to dominate alliances in the region. And of course, the Palestinians also paid the price. So through blackmail and bribery, they brought several countries to recognition and normalization with Israel. They made peace where there was no war, which was very ironic. And in doing that, they created vertical and horizontal rifts in the Arab world, in the region, and destabilized the region. Because what they did was they rendered the Arab regimes at odds with their own people, with their own public. Because the Arab people are still supportive of the Palestinian question, and they undermined the standing or credibility if they had any. And at the same time, they created rifts among Arab states by turning the Arab Peace Initiative on its head. As you know, the Arab Peace Initiative talks about recognition or normalization with Israel only after it withdraws from all the Arab territories it occupied, and of course primarily Palestine. Instead, it's exactly the opposite. Keep the Israel as an occupying power, but give it Arab normalization, reward it. And in doing that, they also violated the resolutions of the Arab League and weakened the Arab League as an institution, regardless of how weak or dysfunctional it was before, but now it was even weaker because they couldn't have one stand on that most basic unifying principle in the Arab world, which is the Palestinian question. Now, in doing that, they also attempted to reposition Israel as a major regional, economic, political, security, military, and intelligence power. This repositioning Israel is part of the Trump ideology that Israel has to be dominant in the region and its security is paramount. And conversely, by weakening the Palestinians, marginalizing the Palestinians, separating it from its Arab context, and at the same time turning the Palestinian cause into an internal or domestic Israeli issue under Israeli control. And the final aspect of this was the Abraham Accords, the choice of the name Abraham Accords, to again reinforce the ideological dimension based on ethno-nationalism, but at the same time normalizing Israel in the region by creating a false shared history, because there is nothing called, you know, the Abrahamic tradition in the region, and Israel was not part of the Arab world at any point. Now, the question is, did Trump succeed in doing irreversible or irreparable damage, and what can be done? Now, there were many people who looked to Biden and said, here he is now, Biden is in power and things are going to change. Biden's promises, policies and priorities have to be assessed in a very candid way. Well, the promises are clear. We don't disagree on them, because he talked about the two-state solution again and the Palestinian side, the same old formulae, living side by side in peace with Israel. They also repeated that they oppose unilateral steps, annexation and settlement expansion. Notice they keep saying settlement expansion, not settlements or the building of settlements. As though settlements are there, that's fine, but they shouldn't expand. And then they talk about restoring economic and humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian people, but Trump stopped. But consistent with U.S. law, because there is legislation now by Congress that doesn't make that possible. And, of course, the assistance to the refugees. And they said, work to address the human crisis in Gaza. And then they promised to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem, clearly, and work to reopen the PLO mission in Washington. And in some cases, they said, reverse Trump's destructive policies, support Israeli-Palestinian security cooperation, and work with Israeli-Palestinian peace-building efforts. Notice it's not peacemaking, it's peace-building, as though you can build peace under occupation. For Israel, I don't want to go into details, but Israel got the usual pablum of the unbreakable bond and unwavering support for Israel's security, the increase in funding, opposing BDS, fighting anti-Semitism, and any attempt at delegitimizing Israel and continue and develop normalization of Israel within the region. Now, there was, among the Palestinian leadership, there was a tendency to believe the promises to the Palestinian side. And they nowadays they're suffering from a massive disappointment, if you listen to the statements now. But he promised. Promised what? I mean, that's something that's really ridiculous, because they pinned their hopes on Biden and they believed his promises and they thought this is a new era, we're going to be friends and buddies with the US. They don't understand that going back to the status quo ante, which we said was a very dangerous situation, is not going to resolve anything, because it's a status quo ante that led to Trumpism and led to such dangerous developments in our region. Now, the actual policies and implementation, of course, they must also be looked at in the context of the waning American interest, not just in the region, but globally, and the declared policy and intention of the U.S. to pivot away from the Middle East, as I said. This started, remember, it was, I think, Hillary Clinton during Obama days that said we have to pivot away from the Middle East and we cannot make peace. It'll burn you, as she said. They started by demoting the Palestinian question and cause. They sent us a second, a third, fourth degree level envoy. They didn't meet with the Palestinians. They didn't develop an American-Palestinian policy, and we'll see how. They said the peace or any political initiative is not a priority. they postponed any engagement and put the peacemaking, so to speak, on the back burner. They committed many sins of omission, buying Israel time for unilateral actions and for de facto annexation. And of course, they created the political power vacuum in the region that Israel fills. Israel usually fills any power vacuum. And they thought, the Biden administration thought that they could maintain the status quo by saying, you know, let's not rock the boat, let's not upset the balance of the situation. So we will support the PA and Abu Mazen to remain afloat, and we will try to manage the conflict. And they asked Israel not to destabilize the situation. And then they maintained security cooperation and funded people-to-people programs, which is, again, another ridiculous concept, that Palestinians and Israelis at a certain level can cooperate, can be funded to do some joint projects, and that will solve the problem. It's not a question that you have a settler colonial enterprise and a brutal occupation and ethnic cleansing, but all you need to do is get some Palestinians talking to some Israelis and cooperating, and everything will be fine. And this gives people the excuse not to engage and not to hold Israel to account. And of course, there was the idea that this is a fragile coalition government in Israel, and we must protect it, and we cannot put pressure on it, and we cannot criticize it, and we cannot ask it to do what it cannot do, because then this coalition will collapse, which is ridiculous. So they gave Israel a free pass for the sake of a very bizarre coalition government in Israel, including the fact that it has its token Palestinian Islamist, or as they say, the Arab in the government, plus the disappearing left-wing parties. Now, the most dangerous thing is that the Biden administration allowed Israel to set the agenda and the priorities of American policy in the region. And they dealt with us only through Israel, what Israel wants, like the charges of incitement, Palestinian textbooks. Israel says, look at Palestinian textbooks, they're inciting, they have a Palestinian narrative, we should adopt the Israeli narrative and history. So they objected to our history, to our narrative, and therefore this is incitement. And not just the Americans, but also the Europeans dropped everything, and they stopped looking at settlements and extrajudicial executions and house demolitions. No, no, the problem is with Palestinian textbooks. That's the incitement. And then they said, oh, look, there's violence there. They are encouraging violence because they are paying Palestinian prisoners and the families of Palestinian martyrs. This is this very racist and abhorrent expression of pay to slay was used not just by the Israelis, but by American officials even, and Congress members. And Israel withheld our money, Palestinian customs funds, on the basis that these funds, the families of prisoners and martyrs, is encouraging terrorism and so on. We keep reminding everybody that since 67, not the creation of Israel, since 67, Israel has arrested no less than almost a million Palestinians. And if you believe there is any kind of justice in the Israeli judicial or legal or prison system, you are sadly mistaken. Any Palestinian is guilty by definition. And therefore, we have a responsibility to these prisoners, and they are seen as freedom fighters by all Palestinians, and they will not be abandoned, nor the families of the martyrs. And they also asked permission from Israel to reopen the U.S. consulate from Jerusalem. Well, we all know it was started in 1844. It was closed illegally by executive order, of course, by Trump. You can reopen it by executive order. There is no need to keep asking for permission, and the Israelis say we can't do that because we have a fragile coalition, or that the Palestinians then think that they can have a capital in Jerusalem and so on. In the meantime, they're trying to change the character and the history and the culture, the demography and the geography of Jerusalem. They also are asking permission from Israel to rejoin, if Israel doesn't mind, to rejoin UNESCO and the Human Rights Council, which is, again, very strange. They adopted also Israel's policy and even the strange construct of shrinking the conflict or easing economic conditions, which again is a very feeble and false excuse for inaction. And it shows that there is no readiness, let alone no knowledge, to address the causes of instability and conflict. Then there is the dissonance and disconnect between the verbal and the actual. The verbal and actual divide is very, very clear, very audible. For example, the human rights discourse rings very hollow in our ears, in Palestine and in the whole region, not just pertaining to Israel, but pertaining to other violations, including Palestinian leadership violations and including Arab leaders' violations. But there is this new slogan now that has become a slogan, which is the Palestinians and Israelis should enjoy equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy. I like that. Okay, so we need equal measures of freedom. Well, good morning, we are under occupation. We have no freedom whatsoever. What are you proposing to do about it? Security? We have no security. Personal, territorial, historical, cultural, economic, human, in every possible way, and Israel is the culprit. What are you doing about it? Prosperity, Israel is stealing our land, our resources, controlling our freedom of movement, and so on. What do you want to do about it? And democracy. Now, they dropped democracy gradually. But if we are to enjoy equal measure, then maybe we should occupy Israel. Maybe we should, you know, steal the resources. I don't know, for equal measure. But this is, again, a slogan that rings hollow also, because they proceed to do exactly the opposite, to maintain and enhance the inequality and the power asymmetry. And they've allowed for the most extreme and ruthless escalation and intensification of Israeli violations, whether the assault on Jerusalem and the continued ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem, or the military attack on Gaza with the horrific destruction and loss of human life. Settler violence, settlers are on the rampage everywhere in Palestine, the annexation and expansion of settlements, the home demolitions. Home demolitions are going on at twice the rate in which they were carried out during the Trump period. During Biden, the escalation and intensification of violation is incredible, it's enormous. And of course, the extrajudicial executions, daily killings of our people with full impunity. And Israel, as they say, is taking advantage of the US weakness and indecision. And they're very happy that they think of the Biden administration as weak and indecisive. And they are quite happy to live with timid verbal reprimands with no consequences. This is what's happening. The rate at which the destruction is taking place and the killings and so on is so accelerated and intensified, it's really alarming. They're creating irreversible facts. Now, again, while paying lip service to the two-state solution, however flawed, as I said, they are allowing Israel to superimpose Greater Israel on all of historical Palestine and destroy any chance of Palestinian statehood. They're too busy elsewhere, and right now they certainly are busy elsewhere. They're going to the UN, they are condemning the use of the veto. They are doing all sorts of things. They've mobilized people to go to the ICC, for heaven's sake, that they punished us for going to the ICC. Anyway, so now they are busy elsewhere. They also, beyond that, went into Israel advocacy. They became agents of Israel in terms of combating and rejecting international legal charges and definitions, crime like the crimes of apartheid and ethnic cleansing. They're allowing for the IHRA definition, conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. They're criminalizing BDS while allowing the boycott and punishment of Americans, American companies, firms, and individuals who dare boycott Israel and the Israeli occupation, but they are punished by being boycotted in the US. And therefore, they are violating the constitutional rights of U.S. citizens, not just the freedom of expression, but the right to choose to be ethical investors and consumers. It is a right, a democratic right for every American citizen. And they adopted the Israeli labels of labeling any accountability measures or curbs as delegitimizing Israel, including at the UN. And we still hear the same old language that the UN should stop targeting Israel. Don't concentrate on Israel. Look elsewhere. And it's the same language still being used at the UN by the representative there. And they maintained pressure on the Palestinians not to accede to international conventions or join international organizations. Because the more you suppress Palestinian rights and oppress Palestinians, the more you maintain their vulnerability to Israel, and the more you create a cover for Israel for its violations and impunity. As you know, there are the famous 22 international organizations that we were not supposed to join. Again, this goes back to pre-Trump and to Obama, and it has been picked up again by Biden. We were punished for acceding to the Rome Statute and to the ICC and ICJ. Now, both of these are on hold, have been postponed. I'm sure you've read that it took them 6 days in order to start an investigation at the ICC of Russia and Ukraine. And it took us 6 years just to agree that they will open an investigation into Israeli war crimes, which are very clear and obvious and blatant. And they pursued the normalization of Israel's regional repositioning. They pressed ahead very rapidly. Ambassador Tom Naiden and I want to say Tel Aviv, but he is convening meetings between the Arab representatives of normalizing countries with Israel in order to pursue the normalization policies and to recruit other Arab states to normalize, because this is how they think that they are making peace. They also ended up the rehabilitation of Israel within the American political system. As you know, Trump took Israel to the extreme right as part of the extreme GOP, and now they're trying to force a bipartisan consensus on Israel back. And we see how mainstream Democrats are really excluding and undermining the progressives within their own party in order to maintain a special status of Israel within the Democratic Party also, like organizations like the Democratic Majority for Israel. And you all know its impact on the DNC, the program, and the Biden platform. They're also readjusting relations with AIPAC and other lobby groups that have gone to the extreme right, and now they're trying to rehabilitate them as well. And there's this ridiculous embrace. I don't know if you've heard when Nancy Pelosi was in Israel, and she said that Israel was the greatest political achievement of the 20th century. I don't know if I want to comment on this. Really, I don't know if it deserves any kind of attention, but what else happened in the 20th century? Huh? Were there no great political achievements in the 20th? No UN, nothing, no two world wars resulting in agreements. It's only Israel that's the greatest political achievement. This is, again, beyond belief. And of course, the increase in the budget, in the military budget, you all know how they gave them a few hundred million extra for the Patriot missiles, because Israel has the right to self-defense. Now, given all that, is there room for hope? This was the last part of the question I was asked. I mean, it's not a question of hope or optimism. It's a question of reading reality, a situation that has been subject to so much injustice and yet so many shifts and changes. But despite, now let's say, all attempts at resuscitating the attitudes and the language of the past, the status quo ante, which was in itself destructive, based on the Israel lobby and the Israeli propaganda and Hasbara, that Palestine is part of the future. We will not be locked back in the past, where we are dismissed and labeled and maligned. There is a process of rehumanization taking place. The narrative and cause of Palestine has become central to the global conversation on rights, freedom, and human dignity. This is very important. And Israel is being exposed and named for what it is: an occupation that's becoming permanent, a brutal illegal occupation, a settler colonial enterprise, an apartheid system, and worse, carrying out a displacement-replacement paradigm and a rogue state, based on an ethno-sectarian nationalism as an exclusivist and exclusionary system which attempts to erase a whole people, their history and their culture. All this is primarily due to a global network of solidarity, of empathy and identification that broke the barriers of slander, intimidation, threats, smear campaigns, and of course ascertained our common humanity, rights and justice. I know it is still painful. There is still a price to be paid if you come out and speak on behalf of the Palestinians, but there are many courageous people who are standing up, who are speaking out, and who are challenging all attempts at silencing them and labeling them. There is, of course, a dislodging of the stranglehold of mainstream and right-wing media that have dominated and controlled the verbal space. Social media has been very helpful, of course. Access to information is there. The relationship between knowledge and responsibility led to tremendous activism among minorities, the oppressed, the excluded, the maligned, and of course among people of conscience, including academics, progressive Jewish organizations, churches, and Congress members who dare to challenge. And taboos are being broken every day. And there is a young generation, not just in Palestine, we can talk about this, but in the US, that refuses to be silenced and that wants to learn the truth and that refuses to be intimidated. And these are our natural allies and partners. And the resilience of the Palestinian people in the face of horrific Israeli violence and injustice, I don't want to go through all that. You know it. You know what's happening, what happened in Gaza. You know Sheikh Jarrah, you know Silwan. You know the old city and Al-Aqsa and the Laysawiyah and Jabal Mukabbir and everywhere. You know what's happening in the face of settler criminality and violence in Sabastia, in Beta, in Burqa, in Sirt al-Harithiyya, all around Nablus and Jenin, as you know, and Al-Khalil, everywhere around Khalil and in Khalil, the settlers are wreaking havoc. All these things are happening, and yet the Palestinian people have resisted. They have stood up to these. They paid a tremendous price, especially the young people, the young men. As you know, daily you hear about young people being killed. But all these things are becoming visible in real time, and they are debunking Israeli lies and distortions. You see the young people defying and daring, and of course the most telling image, as you know, is the picture of Ahad Tamimi defying an Israeli soldier, being distributed as a young, blonde Ukrainian woman challenging a Russian soldier. And it went viral. And then people discovered, no, this was a young Palestinian girl challenging an Israeli occupation soldier. Yes, the emergence of a younger generation and activism in Palestine, connected in cyberspace, able to connect as well, mobilizing with partners and counterparts on a common language of humanity and defiance, empathy and solidarity, active solidarity. These are the authentic shared values, not the Judeo-Christian tradition that is really a manufactured construct, but authentic human progressive shared values challenging erasure and fragmentation and, as I said, intimidation, attempts at silencing any criticism. And what is significant also is the people's unity, that this is a source of real hope in Palestine. Because we saw in May 2021, as you know, during this assault on Jerusalem and Gaza, that Palestinians everywhere, in the West Bank, including Jerusalem, in Gaza, in 48 Palestine, among refugees and refugee camps, among exiles everywhere in the world, among expats, there was a common language, a common cause, a common identity. They stood up along with their allies and their partners, and they defied and they spoke out and they defended the Palestinian cause, and they again legitimized, not that needed legitimization, but in a sense made public the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian identity and utterance. This was very important, that despite all the fragmentation, despite all the factionalism, despite all the geographical divides and rifts and dispersion, the Palestinians have maintained their commitment and their sense of identity and a very clear focus on their rights. And therefore they gain the respect and support of many like-minded people. There is a new dynamic. Maybe it's not moving as fast, but it is moving. Maybe governments are failing, but the people are beginning to rise up. This dynamic is both internally and globally evident. There is a reconfiguration of political, economic, and military power map in the world. And of course, now we have to see the ramifications of the what's happening in Europe. And I'm sure that it will have a ripple effect throughout the world. So there is reason to be confident. There is reason to know that the Palestinians are not going anywhere, are not committing suicide, are not committing amnesia, are not accepting any kind of censorship or oppression. And along with our allies and friends, we will be part of the shaping of the future.
You have been listening to Palestinian icon Hanan Eshwari speaking at the Washington Press Club in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved in the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.